Welcome to Security.com, the podcast, where we're bringing together in-depth intel, real talk, and the human side of cybersecurity. I'm your host, Dan Mellinger, and each episode, I'll be joined by industry experts, defenders, and voices from the front lines to explore the latest enterprise security insights straight from the pages of Security.com and the minds shaping the field. Today, we got my co-host, Paul Miller, and he's going to be discussing one of the big challenges of kind of the security operations center, and that is managing cybersecurity analyst burnout. But first, Paul, welcome back. I know he hasn't been on the show in a little bit. He was pretty busy presenting and doing a bunch of all the stuff he talked about actually in our Hacker Summer Camp episode. But Paul, he actually also just came back from quite a life-threatening emergency surgery.
You know, I have such mixed emotions on this because it's such a common thing, right? Like for everybody who doesn't know, my appendix burst a few weeks ago with no warning. It appears I've been carrying this thing around for quite some time and had no idea. But what gets me about it is it's such a common thing that, you know, if I had gotten checked out, wouldn't have been a big deal at all, but I did it the hard way. And so schedule maintenance before maintenance schedules you. That's all I'm saying. Like if you got anything going on feeling weird, just go get yourself checked out, you know, because this could have been a very no drama thing. And instead it was all the drama for the past few weeks. So, but doing better, back in the saddle and feeling much better now.
Man, I am so sorry to hear that, but I'm sure I speak for everyone that we're glad that it wasn't more critical than it was and that you're back in the saddle and seemingly doing really well. You don't seem like you lost a step here. So
no, I did get to my goal weight the hard way, though. Don't do that.
You know, it's funny. I used to play rugby back in high school, and I broke my jaw playing. It's a long story. We're not going to get into it, but that was the most effective diet
I've
ever been on.
Sure.
So, yeah. Funny enough, that's how that works. Well, we're glad you're feeling better, Paul.
Thank you.
You know, I think wise words of some of the wisdom, right? Go get checked out. Take your health seriously. And that really segments
it does.
Kind
it
of perfectly
goes well,
into the topic.
It? Like, you know, that's the thing that I think a lot of people don't put into the work that analysts do in our field. Like, if you're triaging incidents all day long, the stress level, the, you know, it can be hours of boredom interspersed with sudden excitement, right? But that swing, that emotional and contextual swing the human mind goes through doing that work is pretty stressful. And most people don't even notice until it's too late. So I'm glad we're talking about this one today. It's a topic near and dear to my heart.
Yeah, I think it's really pertinent, especially within the cybersecurity industry, where, you know, we have challenges with having enough people to fill the amount of roles we need, right? Because it's highly technical. So actually, while we're just kind of orienting the audience, what does a SOC analyst do? Like, give an overview of the description of kind of roles and responsibilities, and then what the day-to-day kind of looks like.
Yeah, there's some variance between different organizations, right? But overall, what a SOC analyst does, they're going to be analyzing alerts that are generated by your endpoint and your edge logging system. So you know, you got a firewall on the edge of the network. You might have that data. You might have incidents from attempted intruders and reconnaissance and such that are bubbled to the top of the stack, and then they're triaged by the SOC analyst to make sure that they are a valid alert, not a false positive, and something that should be responded to. And then they make the decisions through a process usually. How to respond, whether or not to respond, so on and so forth, right? So basically, they're the frontline defense. I've jokingly said this before, but I actually kind of feel it. I don't think there's any place closer in our industry to the cinema trope of a hacker duel other than, you know, positions like SOC analysts. So it is a really cool place to be. It's cool work. I find it very fascinating because you're literally engaging the enemy right out front, right? But it is incredibly stressful. There's a lot of things, a lot of pitfalls there that can really get to people, that can be ranging as far as as boredom from, you know, if they're overwhelmed with false positives, right? And kind of a burnout that generates there, and going all the way to, okay, I just encountered an APT and stopped the attack. Do I have personal risk I got to worry about now? You know, like there's things like that that can really get into the human mind and really cause some dissonance with this kind of work. But the good news is there's a lot we can do to change that. There's a lot we can implement and safeguards we can put into our systems to be more responsible with how our SOC analysts ultimately are treated. And I don't want to sound like we're abusing SOC analysts, but it's easy to fall into a trap where they don't even know that they're getting into that situation. Implementing some safeguards can help.
That's super, super helpful. And also, while we're talking about it, I think our second episode of the podcast, if you want to hear kind of some of the results of kind of SOC analysts, because Paul used to run our managed detection and response teams on behalf of customer environments, so lived in these trenches specifically. But he tells a story about stopping a potential nuclear
apocalypse. Yeah.
Apocalypse.
There's no other way to say it. Like in the moment, it didn't seem like we did anything big, right? We just responded to an alert. But when we started throwing threat intel on it, suddenly it became quite stressful because it's like, wow, we did something big. We need to be aware of this. But that's the kind of dissonance that can generate in there, right? You don't even know you've done a big deal until you get past it many times. So.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, talk about the stakes, right? Mm-hmm. That kind of stress level is significant. So, I guess transitioning into what exactly does analyst burnout mean? Like what does that look like? And what are kind of the results on both the person, but also the program that, you know, they're operating within?
So it's an interesting phenomenon, and I haven't seen a whole lot of people classify it. I am not a physician. I'm going to get that out of the way. So what I'm about to say, don't go and tell me why I'm wrong. I'm just my experience.
Yeah, this isn't in the diagnostic
book
example.
So to me, that burnout tends to look like a lack of cognitive function caused by ennui, for lack of a better way to put it. Like almost a boredom that keeps the mind from being able to properly process data coming in, right? Like this industry attracts a certain kind of person. It's usually someone that has some hypervigilance going on, right? So they tend to be really focused on threats. They tend to be able to identify patterns of threats very easily. And the problem is over time, that kind of work combined with things like a high false positive rate and other items that can come along with that can really set an analyst up for falling into this trap of almost, I don't want to call it a depression because I don't want to make depression seem like it's just burnout, but it's similar in the effect it has on people. It's very difficult to be able to do that focus type of work when your mind isn't able to focus. And that's kind of what happens.
I decided, I was like, I'll look it up real quick. And what does burnout, how is it characterized? And you kind of nailed it. Yeah. So I'll just read it out just so we're all on the same page. But burnout is a state of physical, emotional, and mental exhaustion caused by prolonged or excessive stress, most often related to work, especially in this case, or other demanding responsibilities, which is something to focus on as well, right? Taking care of yourself not at work is
a big
component of this. And things outside of work can also affect burnout on the job site with your responsibilities.
Yes.
And the characteristics, exhaustion, right? You talked about that. Cynicism or detachment, which that is very, very on brand for cyber.
This is our industry, right? I mean, we are all cynical about this work because we've done so much of it. I think anybody that's been exposed to it, that cynicism is just part of the output here, right? And so once again, you're attracting a certain kind of person. You want them to be cynical, right? Mm-hmm. In many ways, because you want them to take a look at a threat and be able to remove emotion from their equation to understand what they're looking at. And that's exactly it. We attract that kind of person that is particularly susceptible to these sorts of scenarios.
No, that's a good call because it's people who like to break things and probably have a natural distrust for authority.
Yes.
And like to question things,
right?
Right. Yeah, well, and the other piece that you're talking about, which it, from a programmatic side isn't great, especially when you're trying to avoid nuclear apocalypses, is reduced efficacy as well.
Right. So yeah. Well, yeah, and that's a really big part of it. The reduced efficacy is the indicator we can have, we can see that this is occurring on a team, right? Now, a lot of people want to do things like try to manage this through key performance indicators, things like that. And I think my approach has been a little different. I've had very verbal arguments around this in the past because key performance indicators are good to understand what a SOC analyst team is going through and to identify problems that might be endemic to the process you're using around your SOC analysts, right? But I have not found it to produce a lot of value on the individual level for this sort of problem. And I think it's because we're once again dealing with people that tend to have a healthy cynicism about the work that they're doing. And I think that makes it so that once you set those indicators up, you're getting false positive or you're getting false negatives at the end of this, right? So there is a problem, but what you're seeing is someone that says, oh, I understand how you're measuring this. I'm going to play to the numbers, right? Make sure that I hit those numbers to perform well. Yeah. You know, the whole time sacrificing themselves to get there.
What are some of the signs that you see generally with SOC analysts specifically? Because, you know, we're all humans. There's a wide range of, impacts and how people react to things on a personal level. And like sometimes that may be a literal crash out, right? Mm-hmm. Where people lose it or you get an argument or, you know, they up and leave, right? Type of a thing. Or it could be more, nuanced or subtle than that. So what are some of the common signs and symptoms that you look for with your teams for analyst burnout?
A change in attitude is probably the first one. You'll find people that they don't really contain the negativity or the cynicism that I was talking about. Most cases they do, but there's a point at which that burnout, they'll just say things that seem a little out of character, right? And
they start to drop filter.
Yeah. And it's an interesting thing. Cause it's not always indicative of this, but it's an early indicator that I tend to watch for. I've had some people I know describe their feeling of burnout as being a physical feeling they had. And what I mean by that is quite a good description that I had never been able to put into words, but a friend of mine put it in as they felt like their brain snapped one day. Like they felt like a physical feeling happened that was when they realized that they had just gone too far without keeping their self healthy in the process. I don't know that that's an indicator anyone can rely on, but it was an interesting thing to hear from someone that they actually felt they had a physical reaction to the situation. I think beyond that, you can look at some individual performance indicators, you know, like when they're on shift, how long is their mean time to respond? Were there any mitigating factors in there? Are they having misses at a higher rate than normal? Like, are they looking at these alerts and saying, no, that's fine, when it was actually something that needed to be attacked or stopped, rather? You know, those are all things that I kind of look for. But really, it kind of comes down to just knowing your team, knowing your employees a little bit on an individual level, and being able to hear what they're saying. Usually, they'll telegraph that this is coming and they're feeling this quite some time ahead. You'll hear things, along the lines of, man, I need a day off. I need to take some time off. You know, there's certain things you'll hear. And in my case, when I run operations like this, I try to be very giving with that time off, right? The truth of the matter is everybody in this industry lives, eats, and breathes what we do. Right. We define our personal selves by this work in many cases. And that's a very common thing. And the problem with that is, you, as you pointed out earlier, you never detach. Right. You're always on. And I'm guilty of this as much as anyone. So, you know, finding those hobbies that are outside of our industry, away from our little subculture we built, so on and so forth, is very key to recovering some of that time for me. And you can see it right back here. 2017, I can tell you exactly when it happened. 3D printing saved my brain. It got me, it got me out of just doing security and got me to focus on turning a wrench on something, working on robotics, you know, playing around with that. So it really got my brain working in ways it hadn't been used to working in some time. That was pretty much my exit from burnout. So sometimes it's as simple as having some hobby you can kind of obsess over that gives you a different outlet, right?
Absolutely. And I know I am king of hobbies. I go deep and dark into all of mine as well.
Yeah.
And 3D printing is kind of on brand, honestly, from like a geeky cyber.
Yeah. It's still technical, right? That's the thing. There's still a technical aspect to it. It's still creative. And for me, it really got between that, you know, but having a healthy outlet, the healthy hobbies that are away from the industry is really key, I think, to helping combat some of this or come back from it. Either way.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's very, very Tony Stark of you to go print some stuff out of nothing.
I have an Iron Man helmet right there that I printed.
You got to do an episode with it on.
It doesn't fit. My head's too big.
Oh, man.
I missized it. Anyway.
First world problems.
Yeah, right.
Well, I guess we talked about the cyber skill shortage part of this early, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure how much I believe that because there's been a cyber skills shortage for since security's existed.
Yeah.
So we're really bad at filling up, skilling up, I guess, those people. But why do you think folks seem to burn out at a higher rate for these analyst roles specifically compared to like maybe other roles and other industries at large? Mm-hmm.
The work is very repetitive in most cases, mm-hmm. right? Most SOC analysts' queues that they work from, you see the same 10 alerts 1,000 times a day, right? And that 1,000 is probably low. Like we're really probably, when we were doing our MDR, I know for a fact that we had 100 to 300,000 alerts a day across our customer base, right? And most of those, by most, I mean 99.1% were informational that really mm-hmm. should never have been an alert, right? It should never have been something to put forward to get triaged. So when you have a situation like that, there's a couple things you can do. That helps mitigate that burnout for the analyst. One, you can implement tools that, and this is what we did, to preemptively dismiss known false positives. It's pretty mm-hmm. usually pretty easy to determine using your analyst team, frankly, their output, that this particular, say, threat ID is always a false positive. We know it's always mm-hmm. a false positive. We see it thousands of times a day. And so we're going to choose to prejudicially dismiss that. No one's even going to look at those because we don't need them. And if we need them for deep dives on other incidents later, the data's still there. We can still work with that, right? So that's one of the steps you can do. The false positive problem is probably the biggest burnout generator in the industry because, and we're getting better about it as an industry, but I know in our case, we built some pretty simple machine learning and AI bots that were able to do most of this for us over time. Initially, we started with a system where the analysts were putting in those exceptions and, that worked fine. But we were able to automate that over time, which greatly reduced the amount of tedious work that had to be done by an analyst. And that's really what I think is the core of the burnout issue, is because when you get into this repetitive state, you don't even think, right? It's more just to dismiss it. This is all junk. And then next thing you know, you're not really focused, paying attention. Something slips through. And, so it's a really serious thing. It's a human error problem. But it's fatigue, right? It's cognitive load that causes this. And I don't think enough people talk about the cognitive load of having to do that repetitive, tedious work part of it. So handling that, finding a creative way to handle it. And I talk about some of the use cases of AI on a pretty regular basis like this too. Mm-hmm. I am not entirely comfortable with with using AI to respond without human oversight, right?
Yeah.
However, in the case of known false positives, I am very comfortable with AI and LLMs being used to determine, categorize, and then automatically dismiss something an analyst should never even have to look at.
Interesting. I picture kind of almost like a conveyor belt, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're like click, click, click.
It's the Lucy click, eating then, chocolate scene from the old show, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
It really is. And it feels like that too. You're just overwhelmed some days, you know?
Yeah. And then sometimes, hopefully, if efficacy and attention spans are still there, mm-hmm. you might catch something, then you actually have to go into actual like investigation and response mode.
Well, and that's why SOC's primary mission, the responsibility part of it, you need more than one tier of analyst, right? Like you can't just have your first tier analyst handling these. Like a first tier analyst should look to somebody else for approval before action is taken. And that's a good thing because it gets some review on those alerts, right? It gets somebody with a little more experience looking at them as well. So that's why you usually see that. It's an attempt to sort of mitigate that burnout problem and have somebody taking a little more responsibility in a team lead sort of role.
Well, and before we get into, you know, some of the actual mitigations and how to address the issue, the last question I really have on kind of the cause and effect part of it is, as an analyst, how does kind of the threat landscape actually weigh in on kind of the stress levels? Like are folks actively kind of thinking about like, you know, potential inroads, right? Is mm-hmm. it an adversarial relationship versus the, you know, more conveyor belt type of, workload that I'm envisioning?
So specific days can have value that are very different than other days, right? Like, mm-hmm. When I think about this, I know we talked about the stopping the nuclear apocalypse episode. That was one of my first incidents after joining Carbon Black was in very late 2021. And it was Log4Shell, if you remember one.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
We were the first team on Earth to be able to detect and respond to Log4Shell because at the time we were owned by VMware and that's what Log4Shell was primarily hitting. Right. So we ended up just happening to be in the right place at the right time to be able to pull all that telemetry and build an effective response.
Interesting. So in the line of fire, by the nature of the technologies you were protecting, mm-hmm. so you had early mass telemetry.
Yeah, we actually found evidence that we shared with CISA at that point that showed that we had a 3-week earlier detection than anyone had on schedule. We had seen the initial attempts, the very first attempts, and we actually had record of them. So we were able to share that information to help the industry-wide response as well. But yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I remember just the spin up from Log4Shell mm-hmm. at the time, and that was a worldwide sprint,
yes. Right?
Very stressful across the board. So I think that, kind of punctuates.
I'll never forget after we figured out how to stop it and respond to it, and we'd already been doing it for customers everywhere, mm-hmm. going into a meeting where everybody was very serious about we had to be able to respond to this. And I was like, we've already got it. I mean, here's what we do, right?
Yeah.
So, that kind of day, when there's some sort of global emergent threat that's happening, an analyst's day can really get overwhelmed by that even more so than normal, right? You can see these emerging attacks. And the way I think you handle that is you have to be able to enable the analyst to take some responsibility for doing a little threat hunting around this, right? And let them feel empowered that they can go figure this out, right? I actually think that those days have more of a reward at the end of them for the analyst and probably actually do less damage than a day that doesn't have that kind of stress. I wouldn't want it every day for them, but like, if a team is properly led, you know, a little bit of a coaching pep talk through that and you've got a whole new level of analyst on the other side. And they're usually pretty happy about that.
Well, and that, you know, actually I lied because that just brought up one more, factor for burnout for me is there's kind of the running joke, especially, right, the rapid response teams. And all that fun stuff that you got to be prepared going into like a holiday weekend or a long weekend because that's when generally these types of large attacks or outages tend to happen.
Yep.
So,
Yeah. That's always a concern when there's a holiday weekend, like staffing a SOC during that holiday weekend. You know, you're going to be down people And you know that there's a higher than normal likelihood that there's a major attack coming, right? Like it's almost predictable.
Well, because I think what Log4Shell, it was discovered on Thanksgiving, yes. Right? Or
that's right.
In 20,
we actually, like I said, we found time. three weeks before that, we found like right at the beginning of November. If I remember correctly, I think it was November 2nd that we saw those initial attempts on the system. That we hadn't seen that attack before, so they didn't really raise any flags. It just kind of looked like a web server doing its thing. So, the definitely the public release of that particular one was a Thanksgiving weekend.
Yeah, the discovery was, I think, on Thanksgiving, and then it wasn't technically publicly disclosed, like fully, until a couple weeks afterwards, right? And that's how behind the eight ball analysts are, and in terms of the response time. So everyone's working, like it's a sprint that entire time for everyone involved.
Yeah, and it's important for, and this is something that I was really big on here, and I think it's still something that anybody in this space should be considering. It's very important to have your threat intelligence or your threat research teams working directly with your SOC or MDR teams, right?
Yeah.
And the reason is they are doing that initial targeting piece. They are the ones that are like, this affects us directly. These are threats that are dangerous. These are ones that are complex and harder to exploit. They can classify those things. And when you have a tight relationship between those two teams, you're basically taking that threat intel and applying it directly to the problem, instead of going through kind of a more convoluted process with threat intel where it goes through a clearinghouse and somebody decides what goes out, you can actually generate a feedback loop there that's very helpful for both the researchers and the analysts, because they get direct front of line feedback from the analyst, and the analyst is able to say, hey, I found a new attack I've never seen before. Can you check this out? It makes it a much tighter run operation and makes it more efficient. And once again, to bring it back to burnout, helps with burnout because these analysts now see a path for their career that leads to doing more threat research and such, right? Which is usually what they want to do anyway. So you kind of build this whole culture around that one little piece that enables them to avoid burnout by understanding what they're looking at a little more.
And probably sharing the cognitive load a little bit, right? Across like this stressful experience. Well, I mean, let's get into the actual, like, what are some of the ways to manage analyst burnout? And I guess let's start at more of an individual level, and then we can look at the team level and kind of end with more of like, you know, an organizational policy, I guess, ways to kind of manage or mitigate some of this. But on an individual level, how can analysts proactively manage their own stress levels when it comes to stuff like this?
Yeah, that's tough because it's going to be a little different for everybody, but it really kind of comes back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If those needs are being met, someone doesn't feel stressed from it, right? And so going back to a framework like that, even if it's not that one, I know there's a lot of opinions on what framework is good or bad or ugly. But picking one that you feel comfortable with, that you feel works with that as a leader in this space, and then applying it appropriately to kind of measure and understand what your employees are going through, right? That's really the thing. That, and it shows you care, which also helps push burnout back, right? As far as what the individual can do, it really comes down to doing things that get you away from the keyboard, right? And when I say get away from the keyboard, I mean get away from work, right? Get away from thinking about work.
Sure.
So we've had plenty of analysts that was video games for, right? I mean, that's a whole genre in itself for that. But, I really think it comes down to having a little, you know, making sure you have a healthy approach to life in general, your relationships in life, making time for yourself and the people around you. I mean, let's be honest, we work because we love this work. But we also work because we're caring for our loved ones through that process. And so as such, make sure you prioritize that appropriately. A time for self-care matters. I know it's not in vogue necessarily sometimes to talk about that. But if you're not advocating or caring for yourself, no one else is jumping into that void. Right. You have to throw a hand up asking for a life preserver to get help. Right. And so But approaching that from a way that have healthy, constructive, I won't call them hobbies, but tasks, habits yeah. that you do yeah. outside of just thinking about cybersecurity and hacking 24/7 is a big thing. So finding a hobby like that is a big deal. And finding something that's effective to get your brain out of workspace when you're not working is a big deal as well.
Well, and you talked about it earlier too, at the beginning of the episode, was, you know, taking care of yourself first and foremost, right? So making sure, like, something I've learned as I've gotten older is those little aches and pains, right? Go get it checked out.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, you don't even
go
know.
To the doc. You don't know. You don't know. Yeah, right?
When you're young, you think you're Iron Man. You can do this forever. And then somewhere along the way, time catches up with us. So, yeah, absolutely. That self-care bit is a big deal. And because we tend to attract people that are, you know, hyper-vigilant, things like that, into these roles, that's the other thing, is we're also tending to bring a lot of more people who may not have the standard brain wiring to the rest of the population, right? You know, mm-hmm. neurodivergence, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's self-care there that may be unique to the person, right? Like that yeah. needs to happen. And so, you know, in that case, I would tell the team leads, managers, whoever they are, spend a little extra time getting to know and understand those employees and what they do and who they are, beyond just the work they do for you, right? And that kind of that can kind of boost your awareness of what they're going through.
I like that. So I think coming from the individual level, right, we could talk about communicating up through to your, you know, manager, other folks, right? Because mm-hmm. you talked about from being a manager perspective earlier, having that kind of lines of communication, ideally with a manager who understands. And self-advocating is always a good strategy.
A lot of people are embarrassed to say they're going through it, right? Like yeah. In many cases, it will land on the leadership of that team to understand and know people well enough to be able to detect it, right? Mm-hmm. And so it matters. Building those relationships with your team matter. And it's simple as that.
And that's a good segue too into, as at a team level, like as a manager level, what can you do and how can you set up your team to help manage burnout for these
sure.
folks and keep lines of communication open as well?
Yeah, there's two major things I go after here when I think about this. One is reducing their active shift time. When I talk about this, and a lot of people's minds, you can watch their brain explode as I talk about this, because it flies in the face of a lot of how people organize these teams. I try to keep analysts at a 2-hour triage time, or between 2 and 4 max, right? And that seems counterintuitive, but the other 6 hours of their shift, they're not just not doing work, right? That 2 hours is their active time taking lead and being responsible for what's happening in the queue. Now, the rest of the team, if there's an incident, they dogpile that incident and work it out, right? Like, you build your process around being able to multi-thread an incident so you can be as efficient as possible. So whoever's in that lead point will be there 2 to 3 hours a day. I would suggest no more than 4. There's a term used in our industry, and I don't know quite how I feel about it, but it refers to an MDR or a SOC analyst role that can be referred to as a triage mill, right? And so it's, you're doing a 8 to 10 hour shift, doing nothing but triage and this and that. That is the quickest path to burnout.
It sounds like.
It will absolutely destroy anybody trying to do that within a few months.
Send the analyst to the triage mines.
Yes, it is not something that I can advise as a responsible way to run a team like this. But that 2 to 4 hour window is where analyst cognitive load maxes out. Once you get past, I put it closer to 3 hours. Once you get past 4 hours, it's just a diminishing
falls
return.
Off a cliff,
right? Yeah. So you schedule that, and you build your team appropriately so you can staff for that. Now the real challenge.
And you rotate them through.
Usually what we would do is we would have the team call which shift they wanted at the beginning of each shift, right? Like it's like, I'll take first, second, what? Like they could decide that amongst themselves. They knew what they wanted to do.
Now, I'm sorry. I'm picturing if anyone, another throwback, the Mighty Ducks, the Flying V. Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So like the whole concept of why ducks or whatever, when they migrate, they find a V is the first ones breaking the hard wind. And then the ones behind them,
right.
It's a little bit easier on them and they're breaking the wind and it's a little bit easier on the ones behind and right. They rotate through. So they're sharing the load to make mm-hmm. it more efficient for everyone. That's what I like. So this is the Flying V strategy.
Yeah, it really is. It really, that's a good way to put it, actually. I might steal that for the future. But yeah, it really is. Like, it's a team, right? And if you build these teams appropriately, they've got a lot of strong camaraderie and they've got a lot of strong chemistry they can throw into any situation. So to me, taking a team like that and making sure that they are not burning out. But because as leaders, we can get focused, we can get hyper-focused on the metrics, right? And that's easy to do, and it's not a bad thing to know and to work from. But because we get hyper-focused on the metrics, we may not notice when things are going wrong here. We may not, like, this is the quickest way to burn someone out is to say, oh, well, the priority is just triaging. Well, then you get to the triage mill situation, right? That's not right. What we're really trying to do is stop incidents from advancing, attacks from occurring in a way that that causes damage to the customer. So if we take the worry about just pure triage out and we're only looking to triage the things that matter, then we reduce that workload by over 99%.
Yeah.
Now, the trick with a SOC or MDR team, and this is the one that not everybody thinks about when you think about staffing, it's a 24/7 operation, right? It's not like you just staff for 8 hours. So the real limiter on how you can build that staffing size is not so much how many alerts you're getting, right? It's being able to cover 24/7 and do it in a way that doesn't burn out analysts. Those are your ways to sustainability. So,
yeah,
you know, I suggest, looking at least 4 analysts on duty during any shift. You can fudge that with what fits your operational capacity. Mm-hmm. Like with us, I know our third shifts tended to be a little bit thinner because our load was lower then, right? It wasn't as big of a deal. So I would strongly advise someone to stick to that short triage window where someone's running point for the whole team, more of a dogpile effort when you have incidents going on. And then, you know, all the assorted administrative work that has to go into running something like this can be done in those other 6 hours as well, right? So you have a little bit of everything that can happen in there. And you open up the team to be able to do things like study more about research, you know, as far as threat research goes, or whatever path they choose to want to chase down. They have time to do that. So it makes for a much happier employee, frankly, in this case. And I think it's probably the best way to do it.
That's awesome. I like the, you're freeing up time for each individual at times to develop themselves also professionally on the clock.
That's right.
That's awesome. That's a nice distraction and moving your brain, right? Moving from triage, you know, mining, conveyor belt to expansion, right? Which is
one of the secret advantages to this that I don't think anybody realizes till they try it is that you end up building bridges between other teams, right? Like for us, both the threat analysis unit and MDR were under the same director, but we didn't interact with each other much. And so we started mm-hmm. building those bridges. And what we ended up getting was basically two teams that did very similar work at the end of the day. Like when you think about the difference between doing threat research and writing a detection rule, right? Or let's say instead of threat research, let's say threat hunting and writing a detection mm-hmm. rule. There's a very small difference between those two tasks, right? Like mm-hmm. one feeds into the other. So you kind of supercharge all of your capabilities by taking an approach like this, because those tendrils you build out into other teams to help cooperate more, they build a stronger team. You get into this state where information is exchanged more freely and you're more proactive because of it.
And more efficiently, because they mm-hmm. know the inputs and outputs that the other team person is looking for, so they can tailor their inputs and outputs
right.
to those around them.
And even though it's more work, they don't burn out as quickly because it's variated work. It's not the same thing over and over again, right? So you've got people that are actually engaging different parts of their brain, working through it, reducing cognitive load. Now, the second thing I look for, that was the first thing, took a long time to get there. Second thing, when you're building tooling, one of the biggest mistakes I've seen made across this industry is building tool sets for analysts that causes them to have to context switch in the middle of a situation, right? So if you look at the way we've kind of been working on this for the past 4 or 5 years, we reduce that context switching in our systems, right? It's one of the things with Threat Tracer that Dominic and I talked about way back when he started working on that. That being able to have all that data in one place and easily readable and drill down into it to find more information that I might need. If you can get a workflow like that, you get into analyst nirvana, right? And that's really what we're talking about here. A lot of teams, you'll see them where they have, you know, 10 browser tabs open. And one is going to be to do GeoIP lookup. One's for virus total. One's for this. Get it all into the same interface so that they're not switching between those windows all the time as they work. That causes more cognitive load than anyone puts a good value to. Like the confusion and mistakes that happen just because you're switching a tab is really high. So
I am personally offended by that as someone who always has 900 tabs.
Guilty as charged. However, I'm also not triaging alerts.
No, yeah, and just to provide some context to the audience as well, so Threat Tracer is an MDR, detection response tool, built into Carbon Black Cloud, and Dom, who he's talking about, is he kind of leads our user experience side for the endpoint product.
Yep.
So it's a threat hunting tool, which is pretty cool. If you haven't seen it, I think we have some demos on our YouTube channel, but pretty cool. But it's all one interface where you can triage and then start an investigation and get all the information you need.
So when you're building those tools, think about, and today with the advent of AI, you know, I would say there's more than just the tooling that the analyst interfaces with you got to worry about. But in the case of building tooling, everything should be done to A, reduce false positive load, right? And B, reduce analyst cognitive load during those hours they're working. If you can do those things and keep those front of mind as you're building out your tool set, you'll go far further than almost anybody else you find in this industry. Those two things really make a difference for the analyst experience and really do a lot to fend off burnout.
Yeah, Forrester market analyst, technology analyst, Allie Mellon, she's all about analyst experience. It's one of the first and foremost things that she kind of focuses on when looking at technology, which is you're starting to see, right? I think security has a well-deserved rap for having terrible UX.
Horrible. Right?
Like just horrible, horrible B2B technology UX. But you're starting to see a meaningful change there with some of the new modern cloud delivered solutions in particular. But it's interesting how that yields more efficiency because we've experienced it on the consumer side, right? With app-based smartphones versus old Treos and Nokias and text-based inputs, right?
Yeah.
So how much more everyone can do with technology when the user experience is right.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, when you think about that, you could even go 10 years ago to see the first stirrings of this happening. The thing is, we were in the industry at that point, we were very focused on gathering all the data so that we could filter it and do whatever we needed to give a better experience, right? And over time, those initial steps kind of took second place to being a better EDR, so on and so forth. And now we found ourselves come full circle. Now it's like, oh, we are who we were trying to fight when we started this. We're the mature option. So now we're having to build those better UXs again, right? Like we did. Yeah. So I think this is a cycle we go through, and hopefully, I think iteratively we see improvement. But you know, I'm not the one that should be judging that. But yeah,
everything's cyclical.
Yeah.
Bell bottoms will be back pretty soon as well.
Again?
Again. It's like the third time since I've been around. So I mean, So it sounds like what? We got a people piece. We talked about technology. How can leaders kind of foster an environment where the analysts feel comfortable discussing their struggles, right? We talked about kind of individuals speaking up for themselves. How do you build a culture and a team where folks feel comfortable being like, hey, yeah, I'm on the edge, right? I've been burning the candle at both ends, right? Mm-hmm. Any advice there?
Yeah. You know, it really is a thing with this. I'm trying to think of exactly how I want to answer this, so I apologize. Hopefully we can edit this out. If not, well, then I just did the podcast thing about not editing it out. when you think about this problem, there's a key piece from leadership that has to happen. One, I think it's good for you to set up meetings around this with your team and step away in some cases, right? Let them talk. Let them discuss their challenges. If you're there, you might have a different impact. Now, that's initial. I think over time you build the relationship and you get enough trust that's not a problem. But like initially, have a few team members that are, you know, give them a little extra responsibility and let them be the ones sort of monitoring this and talking to everybody, right? They don't have any authority. Nobody feels like they're under a microscope. Mm-hmm. It gets everybody to start talking and building those relationships. Beyond that, you know, really it comes down to being a good coach. You have to be aware of your team members, what they're going through in life, and you need to at least be ready to respond to that, you know, and help where you can. I mentioned triage mills earlier. You know, if that's the way you're operating a SOC now, take some time and think about how you could do it a little different, right? You may not even have to hire people to change it up. Like, it just depends on how you approach it. If you're approaching it in a single-threaded way where it's kind of like just run into that wall of false positives, that's going to cause problems. So, like I mentioned earlier, if you can step back and sort of organize the way your team runs in a way that's multi-threaded, so it's not just one person for 8 hours doing this one thing, that can really help. That can help in ways that I don't even understand, and I've been doing this for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, so beyond that, you've got to be genuine in your interactions with your team. And you will build a strong team doing this. Like I will not lie. It will look a little weird to outsiders because your team operates on such a friendly and efficient manner that they don't even have to talk to each other sometimes. They're just, you know, it's like watching the 96 Bulls play or something, right? It's like the ball is just going directly where it's supposed to, and nobody's even thinking. You can just see them operate. But having that kind of team, building that chemistry out and creating an environment where people are not afraid to talk about things that might be a little embarrassing. You have to have rules around that. I'm not pretending like this is something you can just do willy-nilly. But creating that environment where the team can exchange information freely and feel comfortable doing so, that means they feel supported by you, and that means that they are going to communicate with you better and let you know when things are up more likely. So, yeah, that's really my advice. Try to listen and be a good leader. That's really the key.
Awesome. Well, and I guess taking it to the highest level now, you know, what can organizations at the highest level, what can they do to start to ease this kind of load for folks?
I think a lot of
on the security teams.
Yeah, I think a lot of places get kind of locked into this whole throw more benefits at the problem thing, right? Like we've seen, I know I've seen that at a few places where it's like, oh, we're gonna give you, you know, a free therapy line or massage or, you know, whatever they're gonna do. Like we've seen a lot of that in the past, and I don't think that's a bad thing. Like I think those employees certainly enjoy it, but it really doesn't address the problem, right? Like it's like you're putting a Band-Aid on it. You're not really fixing it. So organizations that are doing this, you know, step back and look at that organizational structure for the triage teams. Have an open mind to doing things differently than before. The worst thing you can say when you're looking at this is, well, this is how we've always done it. It's worked so far. Yeah, but at what cost, right? We don't know. So taking the time to understand that the way you've been doing it, even if it works for you really well, may not be the best way to do it still. There may be more gas in that tank if you just reorganize things and kind of work through it differently. I know one of my favorite things is seeing a well-oiled team like this execute against an attack, right? And as a leader of that team, I shouldn't have to be in there, right? Like, this team should be able to operate without me. That is what I want to build, and that's what everybody should want to build, because to me, the key indicator that a leader is supportive of their team is building the trust level that they don't feel like they have to be in the room just because something's going on, right? Mm-hmm. So get there. That's really the goal, is to get that level of trust of the team so that they approach you, talk to you, then build out the system that supports them to do better, more focused work.
And as the internet trope, a pizza party ain't going to do
it. No, please never do a pizza party again. Nobody wants this. Nobody wants this.
Awesome. Well, any final thoughts before we kind of wrap up the episode?
No, thanks for doing this one, Dan. Like I said, it's near and dear to my heart. I think we need to talk about it more as an industry. This is great, as always.
Totally agreed. Well, I think that's a wrap for this episode of Security.com, the podcast. You can check out more insights and technical deep dives at Security.com. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and share the show with your fellow defenders. Thanks for listening. And remember, stay sharp, stay curious, and stay a non-burned out human.
Yes. Yes.